Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Today we're going to spend the hour with Rosa Luxemburg and the 1918 German Revolution with Jonas Syek from his YouTube channel, CCK Philosophy. We would like to remind you of Unicorn Riot's coverage of Stop Cop City to stop the Police Urban Warfare Training Center. Check back in February. We covered about 8 hours of Stop Cop City. We're now finding out that city council, especially the Atlanta Police Foundation, Wells Fargo, Chick-fil-A, Hobby Lobby, the cost of the Urban Warfare Center is 3 times of what they were projecting. Think about the Jackson County Jail. County legislature doesn't want to sign a contract because they know the hidden cost could be quadruple. The prison industry comes back with, "We can lock you in on steel prices," while Kansas City is still taking a close look at reparations, at defund the police, actually declaw the police. Kansas is not going back to slavery, folks. We regretted having to spend so much time on evangelicals, as we have lately, with eviction judge David M. Byrne, who now is pitchman for the new Jackson County Jail. A real estate lawyer's only intention of being a judge is to optimize evictions and accelerate gentrification. Carl Lignev and Rosa Luxemburg were executed. We'll tell the story how that took place. The Socialist Democrats, the SPD, during World War I, shifted right and started printing propaganda against labor in 1916, 2 years prior to the German Revolution. Within 3 years, Carl Lignev and Rosa Luxemburg were executed. Look at what was taking place in the United States in 1918. 10,000 anti-war organizers and labor organizers were convicted of sedition and sentenced to at least, on average, 18 months in prison. Ricardo Flores Magón died in Leavenworth, around the same time Rosa Luxemburg died. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G.
In 1916, when Rosa Luxemburg was in prison for her opposition to the war, she wrote a letter to a friend in which she foreshadowed the tragic end of her own life. "I suppose I must be out of sorts to feel everything so deeply. Sometimes, however, it seems to me that I am not really a human being at all, but like a bird or a beast in human form. I feel so much more at home even in a scrap of garden like the one here, and still more in the meadows when the grass is humming with bees than at one of our party congresses. I can say that to you, for you will not promptly suspect me of treason to socialism. You know that I really hope to die at my post, in a street fight or in prison."
Dead men don't rape!
Women are women.
of dying. This is my body is mine, don't belong to the government. This is my body, it's mine to decide what the fuck I can do with it. This is my body, my right to decide is my right to my freedom. This is my body, yeah, yeah, not just a body, yeah. It's time to war, creating a scene, my body is not just a playground. I met with the guns, religion and greed, they're taking our freedom to breathe now. It's freedom to choose, it's taken away.
End of December, as the new year approached, radicals were anticipating a new beginning. A majority of Spartacists voted to finally break away from the USPD, the Independent Social Democratic Party, and on the 30th of December, the founding Congress of the Communist Party of Germany began, held at the ballroom of the Prussian Parliament. Although unsure and reluctant to break away from the USPD, Rosa Luxemburg stood firmly at the head of the new party. The Congress was attended not only by representatives of the Spartacus League from all over Germany, but also representatives of the International Communists of Germany, the IKD, an ultra-left communist group that, unlike the Spartacists, had refused to join the USPD from the beginning. Now that the Spartacists had left the USPD, the International Communists agreed to join forces. The Congress was also attended by three representatives of the Russian Soviet Republic, who had endured a dangerous journey and managed to illegally cross over the border in secret. There were three main points of disagreement that were discussed, contested, and then voted on: the question of the party name, the question of parliamentarism, and the question of trade unions. Given the popularity and prestige that Rosa Luxemburg has, it might be surprising to many that her positions on all three of these matters were outvoted in favor of what at the time were considered the ultra-left positions. On the first topic, there was a disagreement regarding whether the new party should be called socialist or communist. Rosa Luxemburg actually wanted the new party to be called a socialist party, believing that it would be more appealing to the workers who are still members of the social democratic parties, and she wanted to emphasize the continuity between the new party and the old pre-war labor movement. In contrast, those who favor the title of a communist party believe that what should be emphasized is not continuity, but the break, that the new party is completely different from the old social democratic party, which has betrayed the workers and fell completely into reformism. The majority favored the communist title. Secondly, there was the matter of participation in the national parliamentary elections, which the Social Democrats, the SPD, had decided to hold in January. Now, none of the communists were naive enough to think that winning a parliamentary election could bring about the end of capitalism. That's not what was at stake. All of the people at the Congress agreed that the parliamentary elections were a bourgeois institution. However, Rosa Luxemburg saw the elections as an opportunity to popularize the party and present its program to the masses. Her and her comrades therefore saw elections as one tactic of many, rather than a central goal. The ultra-left, on the other hand, argued that participating in bourgeois elections would inevitably compromise the party, as the party would be incentivized to betray its program for the sake of winning as many votes as possible. Again, the second anti-parliamentary position was favored by the majority, and the Communist Party would boycott the upcoming elections. Today, the term ultra-left has been abused to the point of losing all meaning. At this time in Germany, it referred to quite specific positions within the communist movement, as can be seen from this founding Congress. The ultra-left were characterized by their desire to completely break away from all moderate or reformist institutions, their opposition to the parliamentary elections, and the mainstream trade unions. They believed that their uncompromising positions would be the only way to assure the party's revolutionary spirit. It's not surprising that this view had a lot of appeal at this time, as radicals had just witnessed the descent of two workers' parties into either reformism or indecisiveness and compromise. The ultra-left's opponents, on the other hand, often saw them as well-intentioned but reckless and naive, believing that their positions would only end up isolating the Communist Party from the working masses. Then, the revolutionary shop stewards, the radical workers' organizers that had led the November Revolution in Berlin, came to the Congress as well. They too had lost faith in the USPD's potential and were highly interested in merging with the Communist Party. However, their visit ended up being completely fruitless. Not only did they oppose the party majority on the question of elections and trade unions, they also had additional demands: an equal number of Spartacists and stewards on the party executive, influence on party publications, abandonment of the Spartacist street tactics, and the removal of the word Spartacus from the party's future name.
Well, it's time to be a tribute to late General Echo.
A murder sign.
Echo.
A murder sign.
Song long long, song long long,
song long long,
song long long, song long long,
song long long.
Good.
Ka Echo did, Echo did, Echo did dog. Ka Echo did, Echo did, Echo did dog. Me de a London, me say me get a new splash. Me de a London, me say me get a new splash. Me get the new splash, say Papa Echo get shot. Me get the new splash, say Papa Echo get shot. Say, who a go suck up the dance? Da, wah, wah. Who a go suck up the dance? We wah, wah, wah. Echo say din de dan, nga wah, wah. Bra Echo say din de dan, nga wah, wah.
Hold on, Jack.
Say, who no Echo can tell you? Say who no Echo can tell you? Echo used to DJ on a Saturday night. Echo used to DJ on a Saturday night. Some girls in short, some girls in tights. Girls in short, some girls in tights. And then they come up on a Sunday night.
Uh-uh.
And while the Congress was willing to make some minor concessions to the stewards, they flatly refused to agree to all of them. Even though they share the central goal of placing all power in the workers' and soldiers' councils, no compromise among them could be reached. The Spartacists ended up insulting and bad-mouthing the stewards, and the stewards left the Congress empty-handed. This, in my opinion, was undoubtedly one of the worst mistakes of the founding Congress. The new party was already small and weak, and had voted not to seek influence through elections or the mainstream trade unions. But the stewards could nonetheless have given them a mass base in Berlin's factory workers, among whom they had a lot of influence. Now the emerging party didn't have even that, and for the time being remained a small, isolated group without a mass base. The Spartacists knew how important the stewards were. Karl Liebknecht once even called them the best and most active of the Berlin proletariat. And so, despite the unproductive conflict, the door was left open to future collaboration. The stewards themselves were also left without a clear plan. They were sidelined in the USPD, rejected by the Communist Party, and had no intention of further splitting the left by founding yet another party. The radical factory workers the stewards had organized were stuck behind the indecisive USPD, and so left without a clear revolutionary leadership. The Congress ended with the official announcement of the new party on January 1st, right as the year began. With Rosa Luxemburg as its leader, it was the first political party in German history to be led by a woman. Its full name was the Communist Party of Germany Spartacus, abbreviated as KPDS, or simply KPD. The new party was markedly different from the Bolshevik Party in its organizational principles, mainly in its rejection of Leninist centralism. An organizational report written by a party member said, quote, "We think that we must put an end to the old system which subordinates the localities to the center, and feel that the different local and workplace organizations should be fully independent. They should be independent in their activities and should not always wait for orders from above. The Centrale, that is the central leadership, assumes principally the task of ensuring an intellectual and political leadership. The workers would autonomously and independently discover the correct organizational forms. just as they had autonomously discovered methods like striking, unionizing, and forming councils. And so the party did not have to dictate strict organizational orders from above, but merely to educate the workers and to coordinate separate struggles into a unified movement. That is also part of why it took them so long to form a separate, explicitly revolutionary party, which, in retrospect, many Marxists saw as the Spartacists' central mistake. It's illuminating to compare them to the Bolsheviks in this respect. Just like in Germany, originally both the moderate Mensheviks and the radical Bolsheviks were part of one and the same party, the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. However, the Bolsheviks split away from the Mensheviks already in 1903 and began intensely organizing and popularizing themselves as a radical and revolutionary party. This meant that by 1917, the Bolsheviks had already spent about 14 years making connections independently, and so they had strong organizational links with both factory workers and soldiers. And when people became increasingly disappointed with the moderate Russian socialists, the Bolsheviks appeared as a clear and distinct alternative. In stark contrast, when the Bolsheviks had already spent a decade organizing independently, the Spartacists were still part of the German Social Democratic Party, without an independent party organization. They were therefore organizationally unprepared for the revolution, as they only founded a separate party several months after the revolutionary wave had already started. This also meant that many workers were confused about the newly opened up divisions within the workers' parties, and unsure of which party they should support, as for the longest time they were used to one single unified social democratic party. This is a historical example of how the ideal of left unity, which is often spoken of today, can sometimes actually be an impediment to a radical movement. In Germany, the strong desire to keep the various factions unified often ended up leading to confusion or indecisiveness, and kept the radical left from developing its own organizations. Whereas in Russia, carrying out a split early on was precisely the thing that allowed the Bolsheviks to develop such a well-organized revolutionary party. This, of course, doesn't mean that sectarianism is always the answer either. The question of whether to unify two given factions or to split away cannot be determined in advance by some absolute ideal, but always depends on the existing historical circumstances. The lack of organizational power was a crucial flaw among the Spartacists. In April of 1917, Lenin issued them a simple instruction: organization, organization, and more organization. However, the way Sebastian Hoffner put it, organization was not the keyword for Rosa and Karl. For Rosa, the keyword was enlightenment, and for Karl, it was agitation. Their razor-sharp political analysis and unyielding revolutionary spirit created a lot of enemies, without also creating an organizational structure capable of defending them against these enemies.
They'll always want to control you forever. So, if a fire make you burn now, and skin and skin blood and make you run.
The question of centralism, just like the questions of participating in elections and mainstream unions, have remained topics of heated debate among radicals up to this day, and I won't tell you who was right. But the results of the Congress did show that, although the German communists fully supported the Soviet Republic and the Bolsheviks, they acted and made decisions independently of them, and sometimes contrary to their recommendations. Rosa Luxemburg believed this to be a good thing, as to remain healthy, any movement must contain debate and constructive criticism within its ranks. The idea spread at this time by the bourgeois press that the Spartacists were merely puppets subordinated to the Bolsheviks was obviously untrue. But how did the Spartacists relate to the Bolsheviks? There has been some confusion on this topic, as some emphasize Rosa Luxemburg as a devoted supporter of the Bolsheviks, while others emphasize her as a fierce critic of Bolshevism. So, which is it? Well, the truth is, she was both. She strongly supported the Bolsheviks, and she wanted to provide sharp and honest criticism precisely because she supported them. She wrote, "Clearly, not uncritical apologetics, but penetrating and thoughtful criticism is alone capable of bringing out treasures of experiences and teachings." Dealing as we are with the very first experiment in proletarian dictatorship in world history, and one taking place at that under the hardest conceivable conditions, in the midst of the worldwide conflagration and chaos of the imperialist mass slaughter, caught in the coils of the most reactionary military power in Europe, and accompanied by the most complete failure on the part of the international working class, it would be a crazy idea to think that every last thing done or left undone in an experiment with the dictatorship of the proletariat under such abnormal conditions represented the very pinnacle of perfection. On the contrary, elementary conceptions of socialist politics and an insight into their historically necessary prerequisites force us to understand that under such fatal conditions, even the most gigantic idealism and the most storm-tested revolutionary energy are incapable of realizing democracy and socialism, but only distorted attempts at either. Rosa's approach towards the Russian Revolution, I believe, was fundamentally correct. It was honest and clear in its criticism, and did not hide the Bolsheviks' shortcomings, while also being realistic and acknowledging the extremely difficult material conditions under which they operated. She was supportive, but not dogmatic, critical, but not naive. That is precisely the kind of international revolutionary movement Rosa hoped for, one in which revolutionaries of different countries support one another, but also point out mistakes, and push one another to correct them, and to improve their political praxis. Sadly, in the decade after the failure of the German Revolution, the international Marxist movement would become increasingly marked by dogmatism, in which one political line is portrayed as gospel, and dissenting voices in the world's communist parties are expelled at the drop of a hat. Now that the party was founded, almost everyone within it knew that its main task was to grow and popularize itself among workers. At its current state, it was nowhere near large or influential enough to actually lead a revolution, and so the communists did not predict, let alone plan, any kind of immediate uprising. They had no idea that an uprising in Berlin would break out the very same month and would become popularly known as the Spartacist Uprising. This is a misnomer. Yet another highly surprising thing that I learned when first reading about the German Revolution is that, in the so-called Spartacist Uprising, the Spartacists actually played a relatively minor role. It was not planned by them, not steered by them, and would have broken out even if they didn't exist. We'll be right back. The reason for the uprising goes back to a man by the name of Emil Eichhorn, who at this time was Berlin's revolutionary chief of police. Now, I already know what you're thinking, and I understand your confusion. A revolutionary cop? How does that work? Well, although Eichhorn's formal title was chief of police, he was by no means a traditional cop, and did not play the role of a typical cop. He was not even trained as a police officer. He was originally a worker who became involved in party politics and journalism, and when the November Revolution broke out in Berlin, he had garnered enough popular support that he led a group of armed workers and occupied Berlin's police headquarters, installing himself as chief of police. His office was thus more like a revolutionary outpost than your typical police department. He proved his revolutionary credentials once again in December, during the event known as Bloody Christmas, as discussed in the previous video. When government troops, ordered by SPD leader Friedrich Ebert, fired upon revolutionary sailors, Emil Eichhorn and his police department sided with the revolutionary sailors, rather than the government. For this, he gained even more popular support. The SPD leadership, on the other hand, of course, did not like this very much. Emil Eichhorn was not loyal to the existing SPD government, and to them he was just a dangerous radical who had to be gotten rid of as quickly as possible, so they decided to fire him for fictitious reasons and remove him from his post. Eichhorn, however, had a lot of people on his side. In response to his dismissal, a strike was called on January 5th by a coalition of the Revolutionary Shop Stewards, the USPD Left, and the KPD. Pretty much every left-wing group in Berlin came out in support of Eichhorn. In part, the support for Eichhorn was an expression of a wider concern with counter-revolution and a desire to defend against it, which many workers shared. After the attack on the revolutionary sailors, it was clear to people that the counter-revolution was advancing, and there was a worry, even among rank-and-file members of the SPD, that the gains of the November Revolution would be rolled back by force. Many on the left therefore demanded, in addition to support for Eichhorn, the disarming of counter-revolutionary troops, and the arming of the proletariat. The strike turnout was far larger than any of the organizers had expected. There were more people coming out on the streets than there had been during the November Revolution. One communist account said that, quote, "What we saw that day in Berlin was perhaps the largest proletarian mass action in history. We do not believe that there were demonstrations on this scale in Russia. From the Roland statue to the Siegessäule, the proletarians were marching rank upon rank. It was an army of 200,000, such as no Ludendorff had ever seen." Eichhorn stood on the balcony of his police headquarters, along with Karl Liebknecht and other radicals, and said to the crowd, "I got my job from the revolution, and I shall give it up only to the revolution." During the strike, rebellious workers poured into Berlin's newspaper district, which would end up being one of the centers of the uprising, and a section of them acting independently occupied the offices of the social democratic newspaper Vorwärts. And to understand why they did this, I think it's important to talk a bit about the bourgeois press in general at this time. See, when the November Revolution broke out, despite all of the transformations it caused, it left the newspapers completely untouched. There were no effective attempts to transfer control of the press to the workers' and soldiers' councils. The majority of the newspaper offices remained in the hands of capitalists and were firmly on the side of counter-revolution. This was actually a significant factor in the revolution's failure. Newspapers were the main way in which people received news and information on events. It had an incredible power to influence public opinion. And so it did everything it could to disparage the revolutionaries, the radicals, the workers' and soldiers' councils, and to promote counter-revolutionary viewpoints. One of its main tasks was to bring workers over to the side of counter-revolution, or at the very least, to confuse them and to undermine revolutionary ideas. In pursuit of this task, the bourgeois press was willing to be quite shameless and knowingly published lies. It disparaged the workers' and soldiers' councils as being ineffective and useless, made up numbers about how much money is wasted by the executive council while censoring its actual proclamations and resolutions, and portrayed the revolutionary left as violent terrorists, even at times when the government was the one ordering acts of violence. One USPD member humorously remarked that these days, a person who can't read is 10 times saner than a person who reads the bourgeois press. Anyone even vaguely sympathetic to revolutionary ideas were labeled Spartacists, even if they had no link to the Spartacus League whatsoever. workers were labeled Spartacists simply for going on strike, even if they were members of the SPD. Any kind of mass unrest was blamed on Spartacism. Even when workers were acting completely independently, the press tried to portray all their actions as organized by the Spartacists. They became the perfect scapegoat, seemingly all-powerful in their influence and cartoonishly evil in their intentions. It reminds me of the way that even in recent years, the right-wing press will greatly inflate the power and influence of the far left and attribute protests, riots, and unrest to the sinister plans of outside agitators, cultural Marxists, or Antifa. In a similar way, Spartacist was widely used in the bourgeois press as a dirty word, linked to violence, tyranny, and terror, and used to refer to everything that is harmful and dangerous within the left. Of course, the fact that the Communist Party program included a section against the use of terrorist tactics made no difference. This is why the stewards wanted the newly founded Communist Party to drop the word Spartacus. It had simply acquired way too much unnecessary baggage. Anti-communist and anti-council publications were funded by capitalists and the wealthy in general. On the far right end of the spectrum, for instance, there was the Anti-Bolshevik League, whose self-professed goal was to fight against Spartacism and quote-unquote Jewish Bolshevism. It published pamphlets calling for the murder of Spartacists and was funded in large part by the Deutsche Bank, one of the largest banks in Germany. It was the Social Democrats' main newspaper, and so one of the biggest newspapers in all of Germany in general, and it published right-wing lies about Spartacism possibly to an even greater extent than explicitly right-wing newspapers did. It was probably the most effective source of counter-revolutionary propaganda in Germany. In 1916, the German government itself used soldiers to occupy the Vorwärts offices and hand them to the SPD's right-wing pro-war leaders. The paper's anti-war editor, Ernst Däumig, was fired. Since then, it became a mouthpiece for the government, military officials, and capitalists, publishing pro-war and eventually counter-revolutionary viewpoints. A couple of days before the SPD announced the dismissal of Emil Eichhorn, Vorwärts strategically began a smear campaign against him, accusing him of receiving Russian gold, illegally buying weapons, and strangely owning stolen foodstuffs. This was not enough to shift the workers' perception of him, however, and when the January strike began, Eichhorn spoke out against Vorwärts and all their lies to the crowd. The workers grew angry and decided that the paper's offices must be occupied. The occupiers came up with the idea of using the offices to print their own revolutionary pamphlets, now under the name Red Vorwärts.
No special request to our Virgin Demon at once were on the Virgin Demon at Trump. Many people know them as a different name. Some of them all over high like white. That's not right. Don't even sound kind of right. Did you do that? The innocent are so far from the violence. They say the innocent are so far from the violence. Because a long, long time and nobody don't know. A long, long time and nobody don't know. Can't see you without a B.O. Me really can't see you without a B.O. If you write me a letter, me da feel like a better. Write me a letter, me da feel like a better. Show me to Babylon, you're free for me, I trainer. Show me to Babylon, you're free for me, brethren. Free for me, brethren, out of Crossland. You be free for me, brethren, out of one swear. Right. You be free for me, brethren, out of Isle of Wight. Free for me, baby, know that I love wine. They give me inspiration, be sing to me drama. They give me inspiration, be sing to me drama. You take where them right and you give with the rama. You take where them right and you give with the rama. Show me some Babylon, your leg up in me eyes, say now. Show me some Babylon, your leg up in me eyes, say. Cause every night I open pray. One of these days, say you must get away. Cause every night I open pray. One of these days say you must get away. Things is not right without your ear. Things is not right without your ear. I out here and you in there. I out here and you in there. Do me some Babylon, you eat up on me bread, then. Do me some Babylon, you leg up in me bread.
trying to make a living. Time is so hard, them trying to make a living. Giving praises and thanksgiving. Giving praises and thanksgiving. The innocent are suffer for the violence. The innocent are suffer for the violence. A long time now, and nobody don't know. A long time now, I really don't know. Me really can't see you without a B.O. Me really can't see you without a B.O. You write me a letter, me da feel little better. Write me a letter, me da feel little better. Show me to Babylon, you leg up in me hygiene. Show me to Babylon, you breathe in me hygiene. Breathe in me hygiene, not a one's word. Breathe in me hygiene, not a cross lane. Breathe in me, I did not a Isle of Wight. Breathe in me, I did not a Isle of Wight. Don't fret now, worry yourself. Don't fret now, worry yourself. What to be said, it must have to be. What to be said, it must have to be. And what them do, say me, I can't see. But me will take care of little Mary.
Several of the radicals who had called the demonstration, including Karl Liebknecht, were so surprised and inspired by the massive response from the workers that they suddenly became convinced that the immediate overthrow of Ebert's government was now possible, and they began drastically reorienting themselves, trying to catch up to the workers more so than leading them. This sudden shift in attitude was quite reckless, even irresponsible, as Liebknecht had made the decision without consulting the rest of the Communist Party. His intense revolutionary optimism kept him from making a realistic assessment of the situation. In fact, the Communist Party had explicitly decided at its founding conference that they would not attempt to carry out any hasty coups, and that they would overthrow the government only with the support of the majority of the German proletariat. Then the revolutionaries discovered a devastating fact. When the commander of the People's Naval Division declared that they would stand behind the revolutionaries in overthrowing the government, he had actually made this decision himself without consulting the rank-and-file sailors. In truth, the sailors were not ready to overthrow the government, and they removed their commander from his position for making such an important decision without consulting them. In fact, the soldiers in general were even less willing to fight a revolutionary battle than the workers were. They were overwhelmingly tired of fighting, and most of them remained neutral, which reduced the uprising's chances of success almost to zero. Among the soldiers' organizations, only the smaller Spartacist League of Red Soldiers came out unequivocally in favor of the uprising. Several groups of workers were engaged in street battles, using stacks of newspapers as barricades. They saw the advance of counter-revolution and were fired up by revolutionary sentiment, and the street battles would have broken out even if the call for revolution had never been made. They were the result of volatile social tensions that had been growing ever since the November Revolution, not simply the result of Spartacist recklessness. So the most radical and determined section of the workers were armed and ready, some fighting counter-revolutionaries in the streets, some occupying buildings, but what none of them had was a plan. The November Revolution, even though it was in large part spontaneous, had been planned by Berlin's revolutionaries for several weeks. They had developed a course of action. This time, however, it all happened on the spur of the moment. This was really the revolutionaries' worst offense. They called for the revolutionary overthrow of the government, but they had no concrete strategy for getting this done, no unified plan of action. There were no instructions to occupy strategic points in the city, no methods for coordinating the movement. Without these things, it didn't matter how dedicated the revolutionary workers were. Sure, they could fight street battles and occupy buildings, but in the best-case scenario, these acts would only end with a question no one could answer. What now? And with neither well-organized leadership nor a clear strategy, the revolutionary workers stalled and became indecisive or confused. The counter-revolution, on the other hand, was the exact opposite. It had both an unshakable leadership and a military plan worked out in detail. And with every passing moment, they were gathering their forces and preparing for a devastating attack.
Thank you.
Even though Rosa Luxemburg argued against initiating the uprising, it was at this point that she expressed her support of it. The workers were already fighting out on the streets either way, and she believed it would be wrong to disavow them now, especially now that they were facing threats from the government. She still knew that the uprising would fail, but argued that the communists' path to victory must inevitably be littered with defeats, pointing to the failed July insurrection in Russia as an example, and said that a defeat can teach the proletariat a lot more than a compromising surrender. She wrote, "The revolutionary workers were obliged to take up arms because they faced the violent provocation of Ebert and Scheidemann. It was a question of honor for the revolution to repel that attack immediately, with all its strength, if they did not want the counter-revolution to be encouraged to take a fresh step forward, if they did not want the ranks of the revolutionary proletariat and the credit of the German Revolution within the International to be shaken." The counter-revolution took a fresh step forward regardless, and Rosa could never have predicted the extent of the damage that would be done. The centers of revolution were crushed one by one, the occupied buildings retaken, radicals arrested, beaten, or killed, captured prisoners who posed no threat were being arbitrarily executed left and right. Gunfire and cannon blasts could be heard in the streets for several days. On the 10th, troops attacked the region of Spandau, a bastion of the uprising, killing the chairman of the Workers' Council. They then arrested the chairman of the Soldiers' Council and, along with several other captives, killed him. The next day, as the occupied Vorwärts offices were being attacked by Freikorps using grenade launchers, flamethrowers, and even a tank, its occupants had to surrender. They put up a white flag and sent out 7 delegates to negotiate their surrender with the paramilitaries. Instead, the Freikorps troops arrested several of the delegates, beat them, and shot them, giving the rest of the occupiers 10 minutes to surrender unconditionally. The Freikorps were out of control with rage. There was one military officer who had earlier been captured by the revolutionaries and kept in the Vorwärts building as a hostage. The rebels had treated him so well that when they surrendered, this officer shook their hands for having treated him so considerately. When some Freikorps troops saw this man shaking hands with the rebels, they began beating him until he bled. On the morning of the 12th, the police headquarters in Berlin were the last center of the uprising, with 300 insurgents still holding out. It was attacked and retaken, and after the death of 156 people, the uprising's defeat was finally concluded. In the aftermath, most of Berlin's workers were angry at both the SPD and the KPD. They hated the SPD for its role in the counter-revolution, and for collaborating with the far right, who had been arbitrarily murdering workers. At the same time, they were furious at the KPD for having acted so recklessly and irresponsibly, for calling a revolution when it had no chance of succeeding, and for causing what they saw as infighting. Many workers referred to the uprising as a fratricide. The Spartacists' refusal to retreat ended up benefiting the SPD, as they once again exploited the workers' desire for unity, and pointed to the unpopular insurrection as proof that the Spartacists were opponents of workers' unity. So even now, a majority of Berlin's industrial workers were holding up the ideal of socialist unity, despite it becoming increasingly unlikely each day. Just this time they saw that the SPD leaders, who had called for unity in November, were actually sabotaging its possibility themselves. Even workers who were members of the SPD, which was still the largest German party, became increasingly opposed to the likes of Ebert and Scheidemann, seeing them as betrayers of the German Revolution, and demanded a new party leadership. And the more the workers lost faith in Ebert, the more he allied himself with the far right, even if most of the far right saw Ebert himself as not much better than a Spartacist. The uprising was an absolute disaster for the communists, to the great advantage of the government. During the fighting, the most radical and militant communists became isolated from the wider masses and could therefore easily be crushed. The uprising had not only badly damaged the Communist Party's reputation, but killed off many of Berlin's most dedicated communist workers. Thank you.
quiero Che Guevara y revolución, y que cante mi destino con esta canción. Revolucionario musical es mi inspiración. Yo un hijo de la calle, en la calle estoy luchando por el pueblo y para la libertad. El fuego de mi reggae quema toda la ciudad, porque yo soy callejero donde crece la ganja. Yo soy granjero. Comandante Che Guevara, mi revolución está sin sobrinilla. I'm in the jungle smoking cigar and sinfinilla. Marching down to Babylon with me rasta milia. From Mexico to Costa Rica, pura rica. Yo quiero Che Guevara
y la revolución.
Yo quiero Bob Marley
y la revolución.
Zapata, Fidel Castro
y la revolución.
El ritmo de La Habana
y la revolución.
Yo quiero Che Guevara
y la revolución.
Yo quiero Bob Marley
y la revolución.
Zapata, Fidel Castro
y la revolución.
El ritmo de La Habana
y la revolución.
As the uprising was being crushed, Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht refused to recognize just how much danger their lives were in. Rosa was working at the office of the Red Flag, the party publication, while Liebknecht wanted to hold a public meeting in which Rosa could speak about the situation. Their fellow party members convinced them to go into hiding, and were also trying to convince them to leave Berlin entirely. There was, after all, a city-wide hunt for the Spartacist leaders, and a reward of 50,000 marks promised to whoever could capture them. The far right had been looking for a chance to kill Liebknecht since December, and now they effectively had the government's blessing. There were posters on the streets that read, "Beat their leaders to death, kill Liebknecht, then you will have peace, work, and bread." Rosa and Karl, however, stubbornly refused to leave Berlin, as they believed it would be equivalent to abandoning their post. While hiding in a sympathizer's apartment, Rosa Luxemburg learned for the first time of Liebknecht's role in the Revolutionary Committee, finding out that he had signed its notorious insurrectionary proclamation. She was shocked and disappointed by this, sadly asking him, "Karl, is that our program?" The name of the article Rosa wrote after the events summed up the brutality of the situation: "Order Reigns in Berlin." But despite it all, she did not doubt that the revolution would eventually succeed, writing, "You foolish lackeys, your order is built on sand. Tomorrow the revolution will rise up again, clashing its weapons, and to your horror it will proclaim with trumpets blazing, I was, I am, I shall be. On the 15th of January, a Freikorps unit discovered where Rosa and Karl were hiding and captured them. The next morning, as the fact of them being captured was publicized, Vorwärts congratulated itself on the generosity of the victors, who knew how to defend, quote, order, human life, and law against force in the fight against Spartacism. On the very same day, the midday papers announced that Rosa and Karl were dead. According to the report, the car taking Rosa Luxemburg to jail had broken down, and she was lynched on the spot by an angry crowd. Karl Liebknecht, on the other hand, was shot while trying to escape. Both of these stories were complete fabrications. In fact, it would soon become common for counter-revolutionaries to execute communists and then claim that they were shot while trying to escape. The truth is, neither Rosa nor Karl had any intention of escaping, because even after their arrest, they did not recognize the danger they were in. A really depressing fact is that Rosa, assuming that she would merely be taken to prison, packed a suitcase with clothes and books. She wasn't new to being arrested, after all. She had been imprisoned both under the Tsarist regime in the Russian Empire and under the German Emperor, and neither of those brutal regimes had any intention of killing her. And this time, she was arrested under orders not of an empire, but a social democratic republic, whose leader was Ebert, a person she had once shared a party with, and even taught him as a student at the party school. She had completely underestimated the cruelty of the German counter-revolution. Rosa Luxemburg was beaten, thrown into a car, then shot, and her body was weighed with stones and thrown into a canal, only turning up months later. Her funeral would contain an empty casket. Karl Liebknecht was likewise beaten, thrown into a car, then shot. His body was dropped off near a zoo, signifying that for the Freikorps, the communists were nothing more than animals, and he was delivered to the nearby police station as an unidentified corpse. When Berlin's executive council, led by Richard Müller, received news that Liebknecht was killed, Müller and two other council members went to the mortuary to confirm whether the corpse was really Liebknecht's. They returned to the council meeting and confirmed the sad news. The revolutionary shop steward Clara Kasper recounted how, upon confirmation of Liebknecht's death, Social Democrat Fritz Braulat said, "Yes, well, that's what happens when you agitate like that." To which Clara Kasper lost control, hit him in the face and yelled, "You are the murderers. All of this is your fault." Waldemar Pabst, the general who led this Freikorps unit, said that the order to execute Rosa and Karl was given to him by the Social Democrat Minister of War, Gustav Noske. We can't be absolutely sure if this is true, because there is no written order, but it hardly seems unlikely. After all, Gustav Noske had already given the Freikorps permission to shoot all Spartacists on sight several days earlier. Pabst was never sentenced for what happened. Instead, he went on to have a successful career under the Nazis, and then an even more successful one in West Germany. Just one example of how half-hearted the post-war denazification was.
Boy, hey! When you see a wicked man, you be screaming, Allah, sing again, hey, little, oh yes, them are the devil's soldier, oh, hey, little, when you see a wicked man, you be screaming, Allah, oh, hey, little, the murder don't need for them, mama, oh, the loving of some people, Lord, mildew, could I be black, you could I be white, you could I be purple or blue, where you come from, and them the business. Fire
When you see a wicked man, you be scream and holler. Oh, yeah. Hey, little ah. Oh, yes, them are the devil's soldier. Sing again. Hey, little ah. When you see a wicked man, you be scream and holler.
Much of the press presented the deaths of Rosa and Carl as the expected consequence of fighting a civil war, as if they were gunned down in the heat of battle, rather than being summarily executed while unarmed and under arrest. Some say that they were executed for starting a civil war, but that's not really accurate either. As already mentioned, Rosa Luxemburg never even joined the Revolutionary Committee, while Liebknecht, though inciting the civil war, was only one of over 50 members of the Revolutionary Committee, and did not possess a lot of organizational power. The street fighting would have broken out even if neither of them existed. So what was the real reason for their execution? Well, it was an attempt to strangle the young German Communist Party while it was still in its cradle, to execute it before it even had a chance of becoming influential, and to do so by depriving it of its most prestigious leaders. Rosa and Karl were vital to the young party. Rosa Luxemburg was its head, and Karl Liebknecht was its heart. They were, without a doubt, the two most influential individuals within this tiny party. And not only were they famous in Germany, they were also the only German communists to enjoy the kind of international prestige that was otherwise held only by the most prominent Bolsheviks, like Lenin and Trotsky. After Rosa and Karl, there would never again be another German communist to equal someone like Lenin in international renown. Without its two most prestigious and influential leaders, the already weak party was left in shambles. It was a civil war against any notion of workers' power. It was a war of capital against labor, and capital had emerged victorious, aided by proto-fascist reaction. Worker strikes were still happening around Germany, but most of them had lost their political character, being reduced to straightforwardly economic demands. The revolutionary shop stewards, also demoralized, eventually dissolved as a group. The executive council that they had founded, which in November was the highest organ of revolution, would be violently shut down by Noske's troops in August, its records and documents destroyed, an event that was accompanied by mockery from the press. Reflecting on the institution, Richard Mueller wrote, "The Executive Council, I admit, was poorly composed. I'm glad that those days, which were days of suffering for a political person, are finally over. My friends and I tried to safeguard the revolution. We did not lack the will, but we were overpowered by the circumstances. Even today, all political questions are in the end questions of power." After the January uprising, Berlin was under martial law, occupied by the very Freikorps division that had murdered Rosa and Karl. During the German Republic's first election in January, people came out to vote in an atmosphere of repression, as public squares were mounted with machine guns, and streets were patrolled by armed troops. The Bavarian anarchist philosopher Gustav Landauer was caught by Freikorps troops and trampled to death. The leader of the Bavarian communists, Eugen Levene, a revolutionary that has been described as having had the potential to become the German Lenin, was arrested and put on trial. He used his final speech not to win himself a lighter sentence, but to present to everyone what he saw as the accurate portrayal of events. A phrase from this speech would become famous among communists in the following years. Quote, "We communists are all dead men on leave. Of this I am fully aware. I do not know if you will extend my leave or whether I shall have to join Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg. In any case, I await your verdict with composure and inner serenity. For I know that, whatever your verdict, events cannot be stopped." He was sentenced to death and shot. His final words were, "Long live world revolution." The worst violence and cruelty occurred not in the midst of heated street battles of weapon against weapon, but whenever and wherever the counter-revolutionaries had already won and were sure of their power, at which point they would engage in mass executions, beatings, and torturings. Thus, the worst bloodshed was carried out not out of strategic necessity, but out of a joyful and self-assured sadism. It was more like an invasion and an occupation than a civil war. Throughout all this time, large sections of the working class still showed great initiative, bravery, and revolutionary spirit, in many cases putting up an armed resistance. However, they were scattered both across time and across place, and because they lacked organizational unity, they could not coordinate their uprisings to occur in unison. Workers in one region would often rise up after their neighbors in another region had already been crushed, making it possible for the counter-revolutionaries to take them on one at a time and destroy them piecemeal. The Social Democrats Ebert and Noske were on the offensive the whole way through. Ebert seemed to have more moral qualms about presenting himself as a revolutionary in November than he did about being a murderer in 1919, as he believed that the workers' organizations had lost their right to exist and could be destroyed by force if necessary. The Freikorps were allowed to murder without consequence. They attacked unarmed workers, women, and children. In doing this, the Social Democratic leadership was sowing the seeds of its own destruction. On the one hand, they were supporting the murder of workers from their own party, ordering the deaths of the very people that made it possible for a Social Democratic leadership to come into power in the first place. On the other hand, because they still claimed to be socialists in public, they could not win the respect of the far right, and the very proto-fascists they were collaborating with saw them as useful idiots for the crushing of the revolution, and hoped to do away with them at the nearest convenience. After this goal was attained, the far right began denouncing the Social Democrats as the November criminals and defeatist politicians. The Social Democrats pushed themselves into a position in which they had few loyal allies.
We come in dreader, we flash in dreader than dread, Rasta. Don't move, pinky man, Rasta man, don't move. Show them, like how them system dread. We come in dreader, we flash in dreader than dread, Rasta. We are the giants, we come in dread. Dread in our walk, not the dread in our head. Dread out. Judah, straight out of Zed, Addis Ababa County Kingston. We are the liars, we come in dread, dread in our walk, and the dread in our head. Dread out of Judah, straight out of Zed, Addis
While the workers' districts were overwhelmed with fear and despair, many middle and upper-class districts greeted the Freikorps paramilitaries as liberators, giving them gifts and praise. And these were the people who would later form the mass base of the Nazi Party, just as many leading members of Freikorps would become leading Nazi Party members. In a period of brutal repression by proto-fascists, the government hailed the new Weimar Constitution as the most democratic constitution in the world. And while it did grant citizens basic democratic rights, it also conferred on the President of the Republic the possibility of exercising a full-blown dictatorship, essentially making him a successor to the German Emperor, as he had the right to proclaim a state of siege, implement martial law, and even dissolve the parliament. It's notable that not only the brutal repression of workers, but the later installation of Hitler's dictatorship all happened within the framework of this constitution. The Weimar Republic's first years were marked not only by violence, but by growing unemployment, inflation, and hunger. This does not mean that the struggle ended. Social unrest continued to boil behind the surface, as it continues to this day, and will continue so long as exploitation and alienation are daily facets of our lives. In 1919, Luxembourg's and Leibniz's funeral was attended by a procession of 100,000 people. Their deaths caused an international spark, and socialists were grieving around the world, including workers and Red Soldiers holding processions in Soviet Russia. The procession to commemorate their legacy still happens in Germany every year to this day, attended by all stripes of socialists and communists, both young and old. The lives of Rosa and Karl are like distant stars that, despite having been extinguished over 100 years ago, continue to burn bright to this day. As Sebastian Hoffner wrote, the murders of January 15, 1919 was a prelude. The prelude to murders by the thousand in the following months under Noske, and to murders by the million in the ensuing decades under Hitler. They were the starting signal for all the others. Yet this one crime remains unadmitted, unexpiated, and unrepented. That is why it still cries out to heaven in Germany. That is why its light sears the German present like a lethal laser beam. It is easy to fall into despair when thinking about the failure of the German Revolution and the deaths of Rosa and Karl, but they saw themselves as fighting a struggle larger than them, and one that would succeed them, for the sake of a goal that they knew they might not be alive to experience. And yet, they found their happiness in this very struggle. Today, the world is so different and yet so similar. 2 years ago, the Rosa Luxemburg procession was attacked by police officers. Last year, a group of German reactionaries, including military personnel and the descendants of aristocrats, were arrested for plotting a coup. And just last month, as I was working on this video, Germany had one of its largest worker strikes in decades, as transport workers from all around Germany froze the economy for 24 hours. The balance of power is greatly different, but the main actors remain the same. To this day, workers wield the potential to bring the world's largest economies to a standstill. And today, as in the years of the First World War, the problem is this: turning the economic struggle into a political one. Only in this way can the world be changed. Liebknecht, just hours before his murder, wrote his last article, the title of which is still used as a slogan today, despite it all. Because Spartacus, that means fire and spirit. It means soul and heart. It means the will and act of the proletarian revolution. And Spartacus, that means all the hardships and yearning for happiness, all the fighting resolve of the class-conscious proletariat. Because Spartacus, that means socialism and world revolution. We are caught in events that resemble enormous waves, taking us up and down. We are used to being thrown from the mountaintop into the abyss, but our ship follows its course undeterred and proud until it will reach its final. They'll be alive when this happens. Our program will be. Its principles will guide humankind after salvation, despite it all. Regardless, the SPD leaders, as well as the far right, will portray the uprising as entirely organized by Spartacists, and with the stated goal of defeating Spartacism and Bolshevism, the government will utilize proto-fascist paramilitary troops, a group known as Freikorps. The Freikorps had been formed early in December, mainly out of volunteers, and were quickly growing. They professed extreme nationalist, racist, and anti-Semitic views, used conservative and anti-communist rhetoric, and even wore swastikas on their helmets. Many of its leaders would later go on to become prominent members of the Nazi Party. In order to understand some of the Freikorps' behavior, it is important to recognize the psychological makeup of many of its members. Many of these volunteers were veterans who had fought in the war and had found their calling in it, to the point where they no longer knew how to reintegrate into society after the war ended. Many of them were unemployed or traumatized by the war, issues aggravated by the government's lack of support for suffering veterans, and they might have looked back almost nostalgically on their days as a soldier. The possibility of once again living the life of a soldier not only gave them meaning and purpose in the defense of the fatherland, but also satisfied an impulse for violence, which was in part driven by resentment at Germany's loss in the war, and an aggressive desire to punish those they deemed responsible for this loss. The Freikorps were marked by an almost absurd tendency towards arbitrary brutality and sadism, which clearly prefigured the atrocities that would later be committed by the Nazis. One Freikorps commander told his troops that there was no place in his ranks for people whose conscience bothered them, and remarked that it's, quote, a lot better to kill a few innocent people than to let one guilty person escape. These were the people that the Social Democrats were funding and collaborating with. While the Communist Party was founded by a woman and had women's emancipation as one of its political goals, the worldview of the Freikorps was laced with misogyny, a hatred of anything perceived as feminine, and they would later on often show even more brutality against communist women than the men, referring to them as Spartacist wenches. Their military origins were partly linked to the divisions that were deployed to fight Bolshevism in Eastern Europe, where they had already carried out several massacres, like the murder of 3,000 people in Riga. And these divisions, also prefiguring Nazism, exhibited a fervent anti-Slavic racism, viewing Slavs as subhuman hordes, which is also how they came to see socialists and communists in general, animal hordes without a right to exist. Now, however, they were being specially trained for conditions of German civil war, learning how to fight in Germany's urban areas, clear out streets, and take buildings by assault. When the standard government troops failed in their attack on the revolutionary sailors, the SPD leaders came to increasingly depend on these proto-fascists and placed a lot of hope in them. Although most Freikorps members hated even the moderate Social Democrats, they formed an alliance against their common enemy, the revolutionary left. And so the Freikorps pledged allegiance to Friedrich Ebert's government, which felt way more threatened by the far left than the far right. An SPD-led government was funding these people, providing them with artillery weapons, grenade launchers, tanks, and flamethrowers. When Ebert and Noske reviewed one of the Freikorps' units, Noske, Berlin's Minister of War, quite ominously said to Ebert, "Don't worry, now you will see that the wheel is going to turn." And so, when an uprising broke out in January, the wheel did indeed turn. The reason for the uprising goes back to a man by the name of Emil Eichhorn, who, at this time, was Berlin's revolutionary chief of police. Now, I already know what you're thinking, and I understand your confusion. A revolutionary cop? How does that work? Well, although Eichhorn's formal title was chief of police, he was by no means a traditional cop, and did not play the role of a typical cop. He was not even trained as a police officer. He was originally a worker who became involved in party politics and journalism, and when the November Revolution broke out in Berlin, he had garnered enough popular support that he led a group of armed workers and occupied Berlin's police headquarters, installing himself as chief of police. His office was thus more like a revolutionary outpost than your typical police department. He proved his revolutionary credentials once again in December, during the event known as Bloody Christmas, as discussed in the previous video. When government troops, ordered by SPD leader Friedrich Ebert, fired upon revolutionary sailors, Emil Eichhorn and his police department sided with the revolutionary sailors rather than the government. For this, he gained even more popular support. The SPD leadership, on the other hand, of course, did not like this very much. Emil Eichhorn was not loyal to the existing SPD government, and to them he was just a dangerous radical who had to be gotten rid of as quickly as possible, so they decided to fire him for fictitious reasons and remove him from his post. Eichhorn, however, had a lot of people on his side. In response to his dismissal, a strike was called on January 5th by a coalition of the Revolutionary Shop Stewards, the USPD Left, and the KPD. Pretty much every left-wing group in Berlin came out in support of Eichhorn. In part, the support for Eichhorn was an expression of a wider concern with counter-revolution and a desire to defend against it, which many workers shared. After the attack on the revolutionary sailors, it was clear to people that the counter-revolution was advancing, and there was a worry, even among rank-and-file members of the SPD, that the gains of the November Revolution would be rolled back by force. Many on the left therefore demanded, in addition to support for Eichhorn, the disarming of counter-revolutionary troops and the arming of the proletariat.
Wicked must go down, oh, down, down to the ground. Wicked must go down, oh. Run, Babylon, run, Babylon.
Time I say, yeah, run Babylon, yeah,
the strike turnout was far larger than any of the organizers had expected. There were more people coming out on the streets than there had been during the November Revolution. One communist account said that, quote, "What we saw that day in Berlin was perhaps the largest proletarian mass action in history." We do not believe that there were demonstrations on this scale in Russia. From the Roland statue to the Siegessäule, the proletarians were marching rank upon rank. It was an army of 200,000, such as no Ludendorff had ever seen. Eichhorn stood on the balcony of his police headquarters, along with Karl Liebknecht and other radicals, and said to the crowd, "I got my job from the revolution, and I shall give it up only to the revolution." During this strike, rebellious workers poured into Berlin's newspaper district, which would end up being one of the centers of the uprising, and a section of them acting independently occupied the offices of the social democratic newspaper Vorwärts. And to understand why they did this, I think it's important to talk a bit about the bourgeois press in general at this time. See, when the November Revolution broke out, despite all of the transformations it caused, it left the newspapers completely untouched. There were no effective attempts to transfer control of the press to the workers' and soldiers' councils. The majority of the newspaper offices remained in the hands of capitalists and were firmly on the side of counter-revolution. This was actually a significant factor in the revolution's failure. Newspapers were the main way in which people received news and information on events. It had an incredible power to influence public opinion, and so it did everything it could to disparage the revolutionaries, the radicals, the workers' and soldiers' councils, and to promote counter-revolutionary viewpoints. One of its main tasks was to bring workers over to the side of counter-revolution, or at the very least, to confuse them and to undermine revolutionary ideas. In pursuit of this task, the bourgeois press was willing to be quite shameless and knowingly published lies. It disparaged the workers' and soldiers' councils as being ineffective and useless, made up numbers about how much money is wasted by the executive council while censoring its actual proclamations and resolutions, and portrayed the revolutionary left as violent terrorists, even at times when the government was the one ordering acts of violence. One USPD member humorously remarked that, these days, a person who can't read is 10 times saner than a person who reads the bourgeois press. Anyone even vaguely sympathetic to revolutionary ideas were labeled Spartacists, even if they had no link to the Spartacus League whatsoever. Workers were labeled Spartacists simply for going on strike, even if they were members of the SPD. Any kind of mass unrest was blamed on Spartacism. Even when workers were acting completely independently, the press tried to portray all their actions as organized by the Spartacists. They became the perfect scapegoat, seemingly all-powerful in their influence and cartoonishly evil in their intentions. It reminds me of the way that even in recent years, the right-wing press will greatly inflate the power and influence of the far left and attribute protests, riots, and unrest to the sinister plans of outside agitators, cultural Marxists, or Antifa. In a similar way, Spartacist was widely used in the bourgeois press as a dirty word, linked to violence, tyranny, and terror, and used to refer to everything that is harmful and dangerous within the left. Of course, the fact that the Communist Party program included a section against the use of terrorist tactics made no difference. This is why the stewards wanted the newly founded Communist Party to drop the word Spartacus. It had simply acquired way too much unnecessary baggage. Anti-communist and anti-council publications were funded by capitalists and the wealthy in general. On the far right end of the spectrum, for instance, there was the Anti-Bolshevik League, whose self-professed goal was to fight against Spartacism and quote-unquote Jewish Bolshevism. It published pamphlets calling for the murder of Spartacists and was funded in large part by the Deutsche Bank, one of the largest banks in Germany. It was the Social Democrats' main newspaper, and so one of the biggest newspapers in all of Germany in general, and it published right-wing lies about Spartacism possibly to an even greater extent than explicitly right-wing newspapers did. It was probably the most effective source of counter-revolutionary propaganda in Germany. In 1916, the German government itself used soldiers to occupy the Vorwärts offices and hand them to the SPD's right-wing pro-war leaders. The paper's anti-war editor, Ernst Däumig, was fired. Since then, it became a mouthpiece for the government, military officials, and capitalists, publishing pro-war and eventually counter-revolutionary viewpoints. A couple of days before the SPD announced the dismissal of Emil Eichhorn, Vorwärts strategically began a smear campaign against him, accusing him of receiving Russian gold, illegally buying weapons, and strangely owning stolen foodstuffs. This was not enough to shift the workers' perception of him, however, and when the January strike began, Eichhorn spoke out against Vorwärts and all their lies to the crowd. The workers grew angry and decided that the paper's offices must be occupied. The occupiers came up with the idea of using the offices to print their own revolutionary pamphlets, now under the name Red Vorwärts.
Capital punishment. Capital punishment. If I had the key to G. I would have set all prisoners free. If I had the key to GP, I would have set the prisoners free. Cause the crimes of the shepherd who have heard, they have never been tested, none have never been arrested, and the crime go on, the wicked dead strong. Yes, if I had the key to GP, I would have set all prisoners free. If I had the key to GP, I would have set the prisoners free. Where you get the gun that shoot your brother down, or even the knife that take your neighbor life? The frustration you feel that cause you to steal. If I build a fence round a coconut tree, that would cause you to steal from me. Yes, if I had the key to GP, I would have set the prisoners free. Thought that you're entertained in your head, but who I know you would have liked to dead. Cause them not accept your youth with them dread. You lay down every night, can't sleep in your bed. Yes, if I had the key to GP, I would have set all prisoners free. If I had the key to GP, I would have set the prisoners free. Big belly man, sit and criticize. Talk about how the youth them no wise. And every day is just lies, lies, lies. Them shoot another youth for stealing a boot. In future look cute. Yes, if I had the key to GP, I would have set all prisoners free. About it, you see, criminal killing of them society, still them in prison, you and me, and the crime go on, the wicked get strong. Yes, if I had the key to GP, I would have set all prisoners free. But no matter how tall is them wall, when the trumpet sound, them wall have a fall. If I had the key to GP, I would have set the prisoners free. If I had the key to GP, I would have set the prisoners free.
Several of the radicals who had called the demonstration, including Karl Liebknecht, were so surprised and inspired by the massive response from the workers that they suddenly became convinced that the immediate overthrow of Ebert's government was now possible, and they began drastically reorienting themselves, trying to catch up to the workers more so than leading them. This sudden shift in attitude was quite reckless, even irresponsible, as Liebknecht had made the decision without consulting the rest of the Communist Party. His intense revolutionary optimism kept him from making a realistic assessment of the situation. In fact, the Communist Party had explicitly decided at its founding conference that they would not attempt to carry out any hasty coups, and that they would overthrow the government only with the support of the majority of the German proletariat. Then the revolutionaries discovered a devastating fact. When the commander of the People's Naval Division declared that they would stand behind the revolutionaries in overthrowing the government, he had actually made this decision himself without consulting the rank-and-file sailors. In truth, the sailors were not ready to overthrow the government, and they removed their commander from his position for making such an important decision without consulting them. In fact, the soldiers in general were even less willing to fight a revolutionary battle than the workers were. They were overwhelmingly tired of fighting, and most of them remained neutral, which reduced the uprising's chances of success almost to zero. Among the soldiers' organizations, only the smaller Spartacist League of Red Soldiers came out unequivocally in favor of the uprising.
Come not to dread, taking over y'all. In this time I say,